All right, this is Paul's final letter, and now we are down to some of his final words. And so we finished up last week in verse 7, so we want to look at verse 8 this morning where it says, "Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness." Now, the term "finally" can be translated either as henceforth or as finally in the sense of coming to an end. Most people think that what Paul is saying here is that from here on out, this is what I'm going to receive. Instead of looking at the end of his life, he's looking at the beginning of what's to come. So there is laid up for me a crown of life. Now, what's a crown? And be careful, because I thought I knew what it was and I didn't. So let me help you here. It has nothing to do with a crown on a king. Virgil?
I think it's more of a symbol of authority, reverence, recognition, winning, or whatever. And I think that most of us, anyway, we look at it and say, well, it's something that goes on the head of a person of dignity, or the queen or king or something like that. But I still think it's symbolic of something.
Right, yeah. There's two Greek words for symbol. One of them we know, diadem. Ever heard that word?
Yeah.
The diadem is what the kings wore. The diadem is what was a sign of royalty and power. And we only read of one person having the diadem, and that's Christ. This crown is the crown that they gave for the winners at the games. And so it was a victory. It was a sign of a prize or a public honor of, and here, let me read you this one. I thought it was interesting. "We must not confound these words, because our English crown stands for them both. I greatly doubt whether anywhere in classic literature Stephanos is used of the kingly or imperial crown. It is the crown of victory in the games, of civic worth, of military valor, and of married joy, of festive gladness, woven of oak, ivy, parsley, or myrtle, or olive, or imitating in gold these leaves of others." So this is a term for what we're going to receive as a sign of victory. And so the crown here is, and it's variously described in the scriptures. Here's the crown of righteousness. Why would it be a crown of righteousness? How are we victorious in righteousness? How did Paul end up victorious in righteousness? And if you're not sure, just look at the previous verse and the last thing he said there. "I have kept the what? The faith." And what was reckoned to Abraham as righteousness? Faith. So when you keep the faith, you will die with the victory of being righteous. And you will have the crown or the sign of victory, which is righteousness. It's also used in James of the crown of life. "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. When he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life." And then the chief shepherd appears, the elders will receive a crown of glory. And Jesus said, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you
crown of life."
So we have a victory in righteousness, and we have a victory in glory, and we have a victory in life. So we receive eternal life, we die righteous, and we have this crown of glory. So Paul is looking forward to that, and it's something that he has been working for. You remember, hang on one second, Johnny. You remember when he was in front of the Jewish Sanhedrin, he said that, "I'm only preaching the hope of the resurrection of the dead, which our fathers were working toward for all this time." Okay, Johnny.
Yeah, in the New American Standard, that verse it uses the term "will award to me on that day." That shows somewhat of something that you've been working and striving for. You will be winning if you win the race.
Right, right. And that's a victory. We have a song about, "Oh, victory in Jesus." Yeah. The victory comes because he did his part, we did our part. There's his part and our part. Paul did his part, and he makes it very clear, though, "The Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, but not to me only." Who else is going to receive this crown of righteousness? Okay, but look specifically at what he says. All those who have what?
Loved his appearing.
Now think about that for a minute. Why would he word it like this? Why would he word it, those who have loved his appearing? In other words, as he encapsulates his entire life, he says, I kept the faith. But here he says that the rest of the people who will receive this crown of life are those who have loved his appearing. So he puts it in a little different perspective, which I think is very important. Virgil?
I think that it has to do with our attitude of all believers are so grateful for what Jesus has done. We love him for what has taken place and the sacrifice that he has made, and because he is of just his basic demeanor, but also what God has done. There's a side note to this. Not that our love would be equal in a sense, but we still should love those that are faithful and those that are teach the truth. And we should stand by them and do whatever we can to take and help them and express that love in our actions, in our deeds, in our manner of life.
Right. Yeah.
We see so many times where we hear the term, you know, don't shoot the messenger. No, no, no. The messenger teaching the truth, love the messenger.
Right.
And express it.
Yeah, and that's definitely a part of it, because if we weren't hearing about his appearing from those who are preaching the truth, how could we love it? This is a perfect active participle, which means an action that happened when we first heard it, and it is continued unbroken right up to the present moment and will continue until the very end. We love the fact that he appeared. We love the fact that he did what he did. We are so grateful, so thankful, so excited, and so pleased. And every time we think of Jesus and we think of the responsibilities and obligations that have come as a result of him coming, we're excited about it. You remember what Jesus told John the Baptist? Blessed are those who are not. Who are not what? Not offended in me. Blessed are those who everything they see in me, they love. Everything they see in me, they accept as the absolute truth. His way of life. Remember what he told Philip at the end? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. In other words, if God the Father were to come down on earth, would he act any different than Jesus? No, this is the absolute standard. If we don't love that, if we don't love the fact that he came and he gave us all of that, then we're not going to receive that crown. And, of course, then there's the other side. This term appearing is used quite a bit in the scriptures, but normally it's the second appearing or the second advent or the second parousia. This is the Greek word parousia. And it means appearing, but he appeared once for salvation, and then he's going to appear again for what? For judgment. And we need to love both those appearings. Some people are kind of dreading the second coming of Christ, but what does Paul say we should? How should we feel about it? Looking forward to it. Remember what Peter said, looking forward to and hastening. In other words, we can't wait for it to happen. And that suggests a certain mindset. If we love this world and the things of this world, then we don't want this world to end. But if we're vexed by the things that are happening in this world, we're ready to move on to the next world. Does that manifest a different kind of faith? You remember Hebrews 11, where it talks about these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having greeted them and embraced them and confessed that they were what? Strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Now, all who have loved his appearing, that's how they feel. We are waiting for him to come back and take us to where he is. And again, this is a battle because we're caught up in the things of this life, and it's something we need to think about. But when we're told this, it should resonate. In other words, as I'm saying these things, it should be something, oh yeah, I have felt that way and I need to work harder on it. And that's exactly how I feel, because we have to love his appearing. And we have to be appreciative of everything that he has revealed to us. Rob?
Well, and it's very foundational. I mean, we have to believe that Jesus was who he said he was, that he came to this earth, he appeared, if you will, and he died. If you doubt those things, and the devil can help us doubt those things, that's so foundational, everything else doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, that's
physical,
right.
The physical, you know, and I think this probably could be what copies are just saying, the physical, the spiritual, all of it. We didn't see Jesus, so we have to have faith. That's part of what he teaches us.
Right.
So that's paramount. That's critical. And it's interesting Paul would word it that way, knowing that others were going to read this. Yes, he seen the Lord, but we didn't. So it's very, very moving.
Right. And again, as we, if we want this crown of life, we're going to have to work on that, loving his appearing, because that's what he says. All who have loved or having loved his appearing. So it's something that we all need to be focused on, which is, how do I feel about Jesus coming? Jesus said, I came that they may have life and that more abundantly. Well, do we believe that? If we do what Jesus said, are we going to have a better life? But how do most people look at it? If we have to, do I have to do that? Do I have to do that? That's confining. Well, if we see it that way, what's wrong with us?
We're not seeing.
See, we don't truly love the fact that he came to put things back the way they're supposed to be. Remember his statement about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. He said that from the beginning it has not been so, and now what am I going to do?
Putting
it back the way it was. I'm going to put it back. We're going to put things in order here. And that's what he did with his life. All right, so let's go ahead and then move on to verse 9, where we come to Paul's personal comments. And there's a lot of interesting things here. Usually you just kind of rush over this particular section. I know when we're reading, when we get to all these greetings and all of these personal statements, we kind of tend to rush through them because we don't know the people and we don't really, we can't really appreciate some of the things that are said. But this is kind of different. As I said, he's months away from dying. I mean, the death sentence has been passed. And so these words are kind of interesting. The first thing he says is, be diligent to come to me quickly. Now, you remember previously in the book, in chapter 2, be diligent to present yourself approved to God, a workman who doesn't need to be ashamed, handling aright the word of truth. So when we look at that word diligent, what do we understand it to mean?
Focus.
Okay, focus on.
Effort.
So now Paul uses the same term to ask him to do what? To come quickly. Paul is alone and he's cold. He doesn't have anything to read. So he asks Timothy in verse 13 to bring the cloak, especially the books, especially the parchments. So Paul wants to be warm. Would that be normal? You know, would you like to have your cloak? It's funny. I notice this in Africa as well. When I go over there, if you go to the hospital, there's no room service. They don't give you breakfast or lunch or dinner. They don't do anything for you. Your family has to come and stay with you and feed you and take care of you and do everything the nurses are doing, because they're not going to do any of that for you. And the same thing is true in this particular case. You think Rome cared whether a prisoner got all of his rights or not, especially a prisoner who was on death row? So they weren't taking care of him. And so he wants his cloak. So be diligent to come to me. Then in verse 10, he makes a statement, for Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. Now, there's two ways to take this passage, and we're gonna kind of explore both of them, whether this means that because of Paul's death sentence and because he was afraid he might be killed, he left Paul, but he continued to serve the Lord, or whether it means he has forsaken Christ and gone back into the world. And to be honest with you, the evidence is more toward the former. He didn't fall away from the Lord, but only was afraid and didn't have the courage. And could you see that? I mean, let's just bring it into today's culture. I'm in jail. I'm going to be put to death because I'm a Christian. And you know that anyone else who comes to visit is going to be recognized as a Christian and maybe put to death for it. Would you hesitate a little bit about coming? Would you be, well, you know, I kind of like living in this world. If I go there, I'm going to be put to death. So that's a possibility. And I think the strongest reason for that is what Paul says in verse 16. At my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. Does that mean they all fell away? I don't think it means they all fell away. I think that what it means is that they were afraid of the consequences of having anything to do with Paul at this moment. He was toxic. If you had anything to do with him, you were putting a mark on your own back, a target on your own back. So, but anyway, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about Demas. Demas and several of the other people mentioned here are not mentioned in the book of Acts. They don't come into Paul's life until his Roman imprisonment. Because when he got to Rome, he found a whole different set of people. Because he's left Jerusalem, he's left the places where he has been, and so now we have these other people that are involved. So let's go ahead and look at Colossians. Did I not put the verse in? What's that?
2:14.
No, actually, I want 4:7-15.
4:14.
Yeah, 4:7-15. So I want you to read that because we're going to read about a lot of different people here. Richard, since you're there, why don't you go ahead and read that for us? 4:7-15.
4:7.
Yeah, Colossians chapter 4:7-15. Tychicus. Yeah, that's a tough one.
A beloved brother, faithful minister, and fellow servant of the Lord, will tell you all the news about me. I am sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort you, your hearts. With Onesimus, a faithful and beloved brother who is one of you, they will make known to you all things which are happening here.
Aristarchus.
My fellow prisoner greets you with Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instruction. When he comes to you, welcome him. And Jesus, who is called Justice, these are my only fellow workers for the kingdom of God, who are his circumcision. They have proved to be comfort to me. Epaphras, who is one of you, a bondservant of Christ, greets you always, laboring fervently for you in prayer, that you may stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has a great zeal for you and those who are in Laodicea and those in Hierapolis. But the beloved physician and Demas greet you. Greet the brothers who are in Laodicea and Nymphoma.
Okay, so we see some people here we know and some people we don't know, right? Tychicus, we haven't. We'll become a little more familiar with him. Onesimus, Aristarchus. But then we come to Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. Do we know who he is? Yeah, this is the man. And the reason I read that now is because he's just going to say Mark. And how many Marks are there? Well, there's lots of Marks. But we know which one he's talking about because of the context here. So with Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, then, and we'll come back to him in a little bit. Then we have verse 11, Jesus, who is called Justice. Verse 12, we have Epaphras. And then in verse 14, we have Luke, the beloved physician. Now, do we know him? Yeah, he's a very important part. Notice the break, though, in verse 11. These, prior to verse 11, are my only fellow workers for the kingdom of God who are of the circumcision. So these would be Jews, right? So the rest of these people are not Jews. So what does that tell us about Luke? He's not in that original list. So Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas, and Epaphras, these are Gentiles. All right, Carl?
I was going to say, Demas is mentioned in verse 14, where in some versions he's not.
Oh, is that right?
That's what I gather.
Okay, I'll have to look that up. I slipped a cog again. I'll have to look at that.
I didn't hear him say Demas.
Oh, no, he read Demas, didn't you?
Yes, 14.
Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas greet you. Anybody not have Demas there?
Yeah,
Okay. Yeah, no, I don't know of any translations that don't have that. But our problem is, that's all we have. I mean, what do we know about this guy? See, we don't know anything. Now, we do know a little bit more in Philemon chapter 1 and verse 23, where, once again, they are listed. So, let's see. Virgil?
Would the wording of verse 14 indicate that there is more of a relationship between Paul and Demas than what is expressly stated? Because of what he said, the greetings of Luke and also.
Right, yeah, I think they're on an equal plane because of this next verse. Let's turn over to Philemon chapter 1, verse 23. I'll just go ahead and read it, it's very short. Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, greets you, as do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, Luke, my fellow laborers. Now, when you say fellow laborers, where are you raising them up to? Well, fellow means what? Equal. Fellowship, joint participation. This is an equality. He's raising these people, Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, Luke, and Epaphras, to the same level as me. And it's kind of nice to see Paul put Mark there, because what do we learn about Mark in Acts chapter 16? Was he a fellow there? No, he said, it's not good for this guy. This guy's not with us. He's not to our level. I don't want to take him. Well, we're 20 years later now, and what does Paul say? He says, Luke, Aristarchus, Demas, Epaphras are my fellow laborers. So Demas had a very important part. Again, it's all inference because we don't have the book of Acts to get to see exactly what these people did. But when we see how Timothy and Silas and Barnabas and Luke worked with Paul in the book of Acts, we get a concept of how a fellow worker works and what they were doing in that period of Paul's life, these people are now doing for him in this period of time. Carl?
Were these brethren with him before the trial or after the trial? Because no one stood with him at the trial.
Yeah. He's alone. Well, no, he's not quite alone. He'll mention one person, but his situation is a lot different in the second Timothy. In the second imprisonment over the first imprisonment. So let's talk about this word, forsake. When Jesus was on the cross, he said, "My God, my God." Okay, so that's about the worst forsaking you could get, right? But it was also used in Hebrews chapter 10, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. Now, when we forsake an assembly, does that mean we've left forever and we no longer have anything to do with the Lord? No. Now, it can mean that. But when he puts, as the custom of some is, if it's a custom to forsake, does that mean that you only do it once? No, it's custom. People do it a lot. So there is a forsaking that is very powerful, and there's a forsaking that is just a leaving. And so, and as I said, it's the same word in chapter 4, verse 16, at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. So there were none, not just Demas, but none of the Christians in Rome, none of the fellow workers that he mentioned, either they weren't there or they wouldn't stand with him. So Paul is talking about, but he doesn't say they all forsook the Lord. What does he say? They all forsook me. But when he says, may it not be charged against them, doesn't that infer that they're still faithful? Because he wouldn't say that. I guess maybe you might. Did Jesus say, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do? Did Stephen say, lay not this sin to their charge? So it could go either way, but because it's so vague, and what is agape love? If you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, agape love thinks no evil, believes all things, and it hopes all things. So it puts the best possible motive that you can possibly put. It doesn't dig into the evil and say, well, this... Because can you hear a fact and take an evil or a good interpretation of it? I mean, is there everything you hear, can you take it to the worst or to the best? And agape love is going to take it to the best. It's going to believe all things. It's going to put the best possible motive or outcome or meaning. In other words, sometimes I say things that I wish I hadn't said. But if a Christian's godly, how will he understand it? In the best possible way. What if he holds it in the worst possible way? Well, I got my neck in a noose now. I'm going to have to go take care of that. Because, you know, sometimes you say something, and if people put the worst possible motive on what you said, you could get yourself in trouble. And we would the church be in a bad situation if everybody put the worst possible motive on everything we did or said? So, what's that?
It wouldn't be the church of the Lord.
No, it would not be. Charles?
Yeah, also, could we also use the example, think about the example of how the disciples forsook Christ at one time?
Yeah, they all forsook him, didn't they? Now, it's not this word, but yeah, they did all forsake him.
I mean, it's an example here.
Right.
You know, basically kind of reminds me of that situation right there.
Right.
But they all did come back. And the same thing happens to us sometimes whenever we're in a position where we might fall away for a moment or two or something like that, when we have an opportunity to do something or to say something, we don't really think about it. So perhaps we can do it the next time we're in that situation.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly right. And we all need to check ourselves on that because, you know, sometimes we get snubbed when we come to church services. Now, it wasn't intentional. You can go home super angry and say, put the worst possible interpretation on it, or you can go home, be forgiving, be charitable, and say, well, I know they didn't mean it. Now, which way is going to be better? Which way is going to be more scriptural? But some people don't do that. Some people won't do that. But it's here, I really believe that if we read through the lens of the best possible interpretation, then there's no reason to say that he forsook the Lord. And even when it says having loved this present world, now that can mean, what does the world represent? It represents two things to our thinking, right? What does the world represent? Love not the world, neither the things that are world, all that are in the world. What part of the world does that represent?
Righteousness, sin.
Okay. Right? Okay, unbelievers, wickedness, ungodliness, and it could mean that. He loved this present world. He went back into the world. He became a sinner again. But is there another way this world is used? Is this world the place we live in? And so it could just mean he loves his physical life. Is there anything wrong with loving your physical life?
No.
Now, if it causes you to forsake Jesus, it would. But in this case, and as I say, you could go either way, but I just prefer to understand here that he, for a moment, was weak. He could not stand with Paul. He went to Thessalonica, but he's still working for the Lord there. So, and you can take it any way you want. I mean, you can go the other route. I just don't see, unless there's a compelling reason to do so, I just don't see why we should slander him in that way if it didn't really happen that way. And there's not enough information here to really concretely say that's exactly what went on here. Matter of fact, most commentators, as they read through this, they take the same position that I'm talking about here. Not all, but most of them. Carl, is your hand?
Remember Lot's wife.
Yeah. Well, okay. Rob?
You know, some have said that if this wasn't inspired Bible, if it was written by man, you know, you would never read things like this because man would have it all feel good that all these people came and visited me. But the Bible's realistic. And I don't know if I want to use the word human nature, but it doesn't surprise us. And in these given circumstances, what men did or didn't do. And so the Holy Spirit thought it was good that we know this.
Right.
That, and of course, you're going to have verse 17 come into play too. But I don't think Paul's whining or saying anything. He's just saying this is reality, and we can learn from that.
Right.
And like you said, if any of us think, oh, I would have never done that, be careful. When you
get
these situations, we've all been in situations where you're disappointed in how you act.
Right. Yeah, and it would be a struggle because you'd be thinking in your mind, okay, this guy's going to be put to death. If I go there, I'm going to be put to death. But could the Lord use me maybe better if I don't get put to death? So maybe I just say to myself, Paul's strong. He can handle this, and I want to keep working for the Lord. Would that be a sin? You might say, well, not very loving. But when you're talking about your life and your future work for the Lord versus helping one individual, it becomes a tough decision sometimes. Now, most of us would say, no, we'd go be with Paul. But we're not there. It might be tougher to do than you think. Carl?
Yeah, Pastor Peter saw all the miracles. He walked with the Lord and everything. He denied him three times.
Right.
But then he went on to be a faithful servant.
Exactly. Exactly. And I suspect that there's just as good a possibility. And the other thing is, if we take it that way, then we're kind of in another situation, because look at what he goes on to say. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica, Crescens for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Now, did they too forsake him, having loved this present world, and ran off to Crescens ran off to Galatia and Titus for Dalmatia? I don't look at it like that. Once again, you could interpret that way. Now, we don't know anything about Crescens because the scriptures never mention him anywhere else. But Titus, do we know quite a bit about Titus? Yeah, where are we first introduced to Titus? He's the one who has a strong enough faith that Paul can do what with him? Bring him to Jerusalem as a test case by not circumcising him, right? And Paul knew they'd be looking down on him and that he would be mistreated, but he knew he had the faith to do it, so he brought him. And then in Titus chapter 1, my true son in the faith. In other words, Titus was a fine, fine man. Then we have Luke. And we know a lot about Luke, but only because of a pronoun. You remember the pronoun in Acts chapter 16? Goes from they did this, and then in chapter 16, what does it go to?
We.
So the author has now joined in the work. So in Acts 16, verse 10, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia. We ran a straight course. Then in chapter 20, we sailed away to Philippi. Then in chapter 27, when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some of the others. And then in Acts 27, and in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So who went through that shipwreck with Paul?
Luke.
Luke was there. And he was also there in Rome with him. And we see him quite a bit after, as we just saw in that book of Colossians. Then we come to Mark. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry. Now, would that make Mark pretty happy? Because all he's got up to the... I mean, has he read the book of Acts, you think, by now? And what's in there? Pretty bad account of him, right? So now, does this straighten it out? Does this help us see that he didn't die that way? That he was... I think Paul is very charitable here, and you kind of get the sense, even in Colossians, where it says, if he comes, then you treat him well, which kind of gives the indication that how's he being treated because of that that book of Acts? You know, and it's never rescinded, but it's rescinded in Colossians, where he tells them, what was it, chapter 4, let me get that real quick, because I want to read it again. Okay, verse 10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, with Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. So what's the implication there? What's the inference there? Virgil?
There's a couple of three inferences. And one is that whatever it was, which we know took place, that has been... put to bed now.
Right.
Okay. It also indicates that Mark had probably received some counseling from Barnabas. Anyway, that's what.
Okay.
Okay. On how to deal with this.
Right.
And Mark had probably taken the Barnabas' wisdom very well, and worked at that, because it's obvious that. The way the language was there, that Paul was pretty pretty well upset with him. He was not going to take him across the street.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So, but that worked itself out. And
right.
Mark evidently made a mark in life that impressed Paul, and Paul now says, he's okay.
Exactly. And so can you make a big blunder in your youth and still rise above it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And regardless of how long, you know, that parable Jesus gives of the landowner who goes out at 6 in the morning and then at 9 and then at noon and then at 3 and then at 5 o'clock with only 1 hour left of daylight. And what does he pay all of them?
Same
wage. So you can rise above it. Who's another guy who would know exactly how Barnabas feels? Because every time he goes back to Jerusalem, there's got to be some people there who remember.
Paul,
right? Yeah. I mean, could Paul have the same sense? Are there some people in the church probably who are really struggling with Paul?
Yeah.
So same thing there. And when the elders come to Paul, they say, there's a reputation about you that we know is not true. So what we want you to do is take these men and go into the temple and prove that what they're saying about you is not true. Didn't work out too well, but that was the intent. That was the intent. So Mark has been vindicated here, and it's just, I think, a wonderful end to, and it also kind of illustrates, did Paul say, I've kept the faith and there's laid up of me a crown of life and for all who have loved his appearing? Does Mark get to fit into that now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Paul had some doubts about that, but then he was able to, as Virgil said, put them to bed to get them resolved. Okay, so that brings us to verse 12, where we have Tychicus. Now, we just read about Tychicus back in Colossians. That's why I had you read that lengthy reading, where Tychicus was going to come to Colossae, and he was one of them, I think is how it was put. So, Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. Bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas when you come. Now, what do we know about Troas? A couple interesting events happened at Troas.
Acts 20 and 7.
Okay, Acts 20 and 7. That's where the disciples came together to break bread. But there's another thing that happened in Troas. Remember Paul, when he wrote the 1 Corinthian letter, he said, I came to Troas and I didn't find Titus. So I came across the sea. I left an opportunity there. Well, did he get a chance to go back to Troas if he left his cloak there? So he was able to resolve that. I'm trying to remember, when they got their vision to go into Macedonia, was that also Troas? That'd be in Acts 16. Well, wait a minute. We have it in here because that's the one where we had Luke. I'll look at it later and find it. I can't remember. But Troas has a good history. And Paul has left a cloak there, which means it was probably turning to summer. So what does he say? I don't need this. So he leaves it there, probably expecting to come back. And then what happens? He gets put in prison. So now bring the cloak when you come, and the books, especially the parchments. Now, what's the difference between a book and a parchment? Okay, it's about this period of time. Now, prior to this, everything was written on scrolls, right? And those would be the parchments. But Rome brought in a different way of writing, and they had a book more like what we have. The Jews, they had scrolls. They had parchments where you would just turn it and turn it and turn it until you found the place that you wanted to read. No chapters, no verses. Did you have to know your Bible pretty well to find that? I mean, if you're preaching a sermon, you're having to roll through 66 chapters of Isaiah, find the right spot without chapters and without verses. Would that be a challenge? So we're really blessed. I mean, we're really blessed to have the Bible the way we do. And about this same time is when Peter is saying in 2 Peter chapter 3, that all about scriptures, they rest the scriptures to their own destruction. And who else's scriptures do they rest? Paul. Paul's writings are also scriptures. So there's a lot of books floating around at this point. At this point in the history of the canon, we have all of Paul's writings. They're already available. We also have at least one and maybe two of Peter's books. We should have, at this point, most of the Gospels that are written. And who wrote one of the Gospels? Well, Luke, and who's the other guy? Mark. So Mark's there, he's useful, and Luke's there, and he's useful, and Mark's written a book, and Luke has written a book, and Paul wants him to bring some of them, bring some of these books. Is that the second bell or the first bell? Oh, okay. All right. So especially the parchments. So like I said, Paul's cold and bored. Is that a fair assessment? He wants something. He wants his coat and he wants something to read. And that's, I guess that's tongue in cheek. He may not have been bored at all. Although, was he getting any visitors? No. Did he have anything? Did he have any books and parchments? At least not these. So he's wanting those things. All right, Carl.
We do know that during his imprisonment that he converted several of the guards in the court.
Well, that was the first imprisonment. Yeah, you're right. In Philippians, he writes about the fact that his imprisonment had gone to the furtherance of the gospel, and he was able to preach to people, and the entire Praetorian Guard had heard the gospel. Because remember, he was in Rome in his own hired house, but there were soldiers there guarding him. So when everybody came for him to preach, what were the soldiers getting to hear? So over time, they all heard the gospel. Now, he doesn't say whether they obeyed it or not, but they certainly heard and had the opportunity to obey it. And I don't know where those guys are now. But as I said, Paul must be toxic, right? I mean, why would everybody be leaving? Why would they be forsaking him? Why would all forsake him? Because, and remember, we're right around the corner. After the death of Paul and some of the other apostles, the great persecutions of Nero and Domitian, they all started about this time. And so there was some real concern among the Christians. They knew what was coming. And so some of them, again, does it take a lot of faith to go into that kind of a situation? It takes a lot of faith. And so... okay, any other thoughts on that? All right, then let's just quickly look at verse 14. We'll just go over it a little bit. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works. You also must beware of him, for he has greatly resisted our words. Now, that's all we know about this man. We don't know where he's from. Now, we remember the silversmiths. Remember the silversmiths in Ephesus? Did they do Paul great harm? Yeah, they started a riot. And Paul said, I had the death sentence passed within me. I knew I was going to go in there because he wanted to save his friends who had been taken captive. But all of the rulers were telling him, Paul, don't go in there, because if he'd gone in there, he very likely would have been killed. So, but this man is a coppersmith, not a silversmith, and we don't know where he's from. It doesn't really say, and as far as I can recall, he's not mentioned anywhere else in the scriptures. What kind of harm might Alexander the coppersmith do? Okay, you got a whole week to think about it because the bell just rang. No, Virgil, go ahead.
No, I would just, and you're right, it would be just a guess, but that he spent his time slandering.
Okay. He could be the reason Paul has a death sentence, right? He could be the one who went in there. You remember in Philippians it said, some are preaching Christ out of a desire to get me to be punished. They're doing it for thinking to stir up adversity for Paul. And so it's very, very possible that that's what this is. All right. Well, next week we will go ahead and I'm pretty sure we'll finish the book. And I was going to start printing out the books for the next class, and my printer went down yesterday. I can't get it to work, so I didn't have time to deal with it. I had a bunch going on yesterday as far as work. So I'll try to get that done and get it out. We're going to go into 1 John. I have a real nice commentary. You can see it in the back there. And we're going to go through that. And because I already have it written, I'm going to give you questions every week. So you can read the material and answer the questions. All right. That's it for today. Thank you.